WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. You probably know Andy Borowitz from his column in The New Yorker, The Borowitz Report. And he's been writing satire and humor for decades. He started out in the world of sitcoms.
As a sitcom writer, you need characters that you can throw stuff to every week, week in, week out, who are dependable and will get the laugh. And politicians become kind of this little sitcom cast because we know how they're going to behave. We know that Rudy Giuliani is going to be the crazy drunk guy, and Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to talk about Jewish space lasers. And so they become very reliable sources of comedy.
It's probably not surprising at all that Andy ended up writing about politics. But his new book, while funny, is not really satire. It's called Profiles in Ignorance. And Andy believes we're now living at a time that some of our smartest, most educated politicians are actually just pretending to be dumb in order to get elected. Andy, welcome. The book is hilarious. I have to say, the subtitle of the book is How America's Politicians Got Dumb and Dumber. And it's mostly about, obviously, modern politicians. Were there no dummies early on?
No, there were. Apparently, this whole trend of dumbing down of politicians started during the 17th century. What happened in the 17th century was that the Puritans were big readers. They mainly read one book, but they were big readers.
It was a good book.
It was an excellent book. And then a bunch of Dutch revivalists came in, and they started being much more theatrical and writhing on the floor and hollering and yelling and all this stuff. And so they quickly upstaged the Puritans. And we've been sort of reenacting that ever since, where we like politicians who can perform over politicians who know stuff.
What would you say is the zenith of politicians who know stuff? I assume it's the Enlightenment period and the period of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and things like that.
Yes, I think that's true. And as a result, none of those guys are in my book because they're not funny. I focused really on the last 50 years. And the reason why I did that, it wasn't totally arbitrary, which was that the last 50 years was when TV got into the mix and really started with the Kennedy-Nixon debates.
Now, my point is this. Senator Kennedy has got to be consistent here. Either he's for the president and he's against the position that those who oppose the president in 55...
Two guys, by the way, who were both well-informed. The problem was Kennedy was much better on TV than Nixon. He had much better hair. And that really sort of started the trend of politicians needing to have good hair whenever possible. So you got people like Rob Blagojevich and John Edwards, who had other
fantastic
problems.
Fantastic hair. Blagojevich had fantastic hair.
The best hair. The
ever.
Best hair. But what really happened with that debate was it taught people a lesson, and it was kind of a dangerous lesson, which is it's important for politicians to be good on TV. And Republicans in California kind of reverse engineered this, and they said, rather than finding a politician like Nixon who's well-informed but loses the gubernatorial election because he's horrible on TV, let's find somebody who's great on TV and doesn't know anything, but we can fill him with knowledge. And that's how we got Governor Ronald Reagan.
You've heard a great deal about my lack of experience. That's true. Lack of experience actually in holding public office. But I know that there comes some times when if you want a job done, maybe you get somebody in who hasn't found out all the things you can't do.
The start of the book, in some sense, is Ronald Reagan's ascent.
Yes, yes. He is the towering icon of ignorance in this story. And this is one thing I should say about the book is nothing in this book is just my opinion. It's very documented. It's facts. It's not me just calling people names. I don't call people idiots. Mm-hmm. I will call them ignoramus, because that is actually a technical term. And ignoramus is somebody who doesn't know things.
But is it possible to argue that this enterprise, this discussion, is conservatives equals ignorant and liberal and to the left it means enlightened somehow? And one can only imagine that certain listeners listening to this see this as an exercise in left-leaning snobbery or condescension.
That is a great question. I think that this issue of anti-intellectualism has really affected both parties. So Bill Clinton's a great example. Extremely well-educated guy, extremely full of knowledge. But when he first ran in 1992, there was a lot of concern that he was too wonky and too nerdy because he had gone to Yale Law School and he'd been a Rhodes Scholar and had gone to Oxford. And the Democrats had a really bad record of nominating these guys who were considered eggheads. So by the time Clinton came around, this was a concern. And his way of addressing it, rather than owning how smart he was, is he started doing Elvis imitations. And he went on the Arsenio Hall show and put on Ray-Bans and played Heartbreak Hotel on the sax. And he was basically saying, hey, look, I'm not really that smart. Right. And that was supposed to be a good thing.
Talking about what kind of underwear he wore.
Yeah, exactly. On MTV, boxers or briefs. So it wasn't like the Democrats looked at this anti-intellectual trend and said, we'll have none of that. They eventually succumbed. And really, both Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, when they were looking for a political role model for their presentation, how to make their argument as a candidate, they looked to Ronald Reagan, one of the least informed presidents in American history. So the least informed president became a role model for some of our most egg-heady politicians.
Andy, you describe the last 50 years of American politics as the age of ignorance, and you divide it into three stages: ridicule, acceptance, and celebration.
Yeah, to summarize, in ridicule, dumb politicians pretended to be smart. In the acceptance phase, George W. Bush, dumb politicians could be proud of being dumb. And then we have people like Josh Hawley, who's extremely well-educated and extremely smart, and they are part of what I would call the celebration phase of ignorance, which is they are smart guys pretending to be dumb because it helps them electorally.
That's Tom Cotton is another, it seems.
Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz. I mean, there's a whole lot of them.
So along comes Donald Trump. Need I say more? And where does he fit in all of this?
Well, what was interesting in researching the book was that, you know, when Trump was elected, a lot of us supposedly knowledgeable people were taken by surprise by this. It just seemed unfathomable, and it was like just such a sock in the gut. But the more I researched the past 50 years, the more likely, plausible, and maybe even inevitable his election was, because he actually had a great deal in common with his forebears. But I think with him, it was more, I think the thing that was different about him was that he was really the icon of the celebration phase, in that his ignorance and his ability to make up facts and to say really recklessly dumb things like we should all ingest bleach.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside? Or
that became sort of a tribal banner that people wanted to wave. The notion that you had somebody who was saying things that were so ill-informed.
I somehow remember, and it seemed hilarious at the time, but it seems like almost nothing now, that the Vice President of the United States, Dan Quayle, visited a classroom and he I think, corrected a school kid's spelling of the word potato, but unfortunately, Quail got it wrong.
Yeah, this happened in 1992, towards the end of his vice presidency, and he was in a middle school classroom, and actually the kid in question was named William Figueroa. The word he had to spell was potato, and Dan Quayle said, "You've almost got it right there. You need to add a little something at the end."
"And add one little bit on the end. Just think of potato. How's it?"
He hectored the kid into adding an E, thus disfiguring his correctly spelled word. And that really became the thing. That's the thing that he's best known for. And Trump misspelled things on Twitter about once every 5 days, when he was still allowed on Twitter.
"Late last night, the president tweeted, 'Despite the constant negative press, kafefe.'"
And it never became an issue at all.
There's been no shortage of comic writing about this. But at the same time, it doesn't embarrass Donald Trump to misspell a word every 2 seconds on Twitter. I distinctly remember him saying, by way of compliment, "I love the uneducated."
Right.
"Where are my uneducated people?" This kind of thing. And that's not to say that people who have not had the advantage of an advanced education or a fine one should be looked down on. In fact, I think Trump scorns them as much as he scorns anybody, but is able to use it to his political advantage, is able to use the comedy about him to his political advantage, too. So what's to be done about this?
Well, you know, this might be my cockeyed optimism. I am an optimistic person, actually, and I'm a little bit of an idealist. And I do think that history doesn't move in a straight line. I think we've been in a very dumb period. The last 50 years have been trending dumbwards, clearly. But there's some hopeful signs. I thought it was really interesting that the good people of Alaska decided that they'd had enough of Sarah Palin. I think that Sarah Palin's status as a national joke really finally caught up with her. And I think it was a contributing factor. I think that there are other things about Sarah Palin that were turned off to people. The fact that she quit halfway through her term as governor probably didn't help her.
I guess I feel after a while that the times are such, and it's different from this sort of high moment of Jon Stewart and some other, that it's not always funny anymore. You know, that, you know, these conspiracy theories and Jewish space lasers and the things that come out of Trump's mouth and Ted Cruz's mouth, which would have, in a different context, seemed hilarious, now seem just dangerous. You ever feel that way?
I think it's both, really. I mean, I feel like this might be a manifestation of my cockeyed optimism, but I love this Will Rogers quote, and I quoted in the book where Will Rogers said, "There's no trick to being a political humorist when you have the whole government working for you." And I feel that we've lived through really terrible times in this country, which in retrospect, they're in the midst of time now, in the midst of the past. So we don't, we're not living them viscerally anymore. But the McCarthy era was an era of conspiracy theories, and a lot of people's lives were ruined. It wasn't just a question of somebody tweeting out a nasty, mean tweet. It was entire careers were ruined. And, you know, the early 1950s through the 1960s was a time where we were living on the precipice of nuclear annihilation. That wasn't really fun either. And yet people still, George Carlin was making jokes. And
Dr. Strangelove was made.
Yeah. I mean, every now and then people will say things like Tom Lehrer, the comedy songwriter, famously said that satire died when Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize. I get his point, but I just don't think it ever dies, because I think we've always lived in absurd, terrible times, some less terrible than others. But we find a way to laugh because it's really our survival, I think.
Andy Borowitz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Andy Borowitz's new book is called Profiles in Ignorance. I'm David Remnick. More in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. obvious, but with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As a species, the lionfish is absolutely stunning to look at. They're native to the Indian and Pacific Oceans, but maybe you've also seen them in aquariums. They're very hard to miss.
They have long, multicolored spines and bright colors. They're beautiful. They look like Las Vegas dancers. They look like they look like something that nature invented to delight us.
This is DT Max, Dan Max. He's a longtime writer for the magazine, and he's covered topics from arts and culture to medicine and science. But he didn't expect himself to be on the lionfish beat.
Most stories begin with either you read something somewhere and then you make some, you send some emails, or otherwise maybe somebody says something to you and you go, oh, that's a good story. This one began with my son needing to do something in the summer and deciding he was going to go to camp. He was looking online and he found a camp in Belize called Reef Conservation International, and it had the usual environmental activities that you would expect in Belize. So for one thing, they were going to do was a beach cleanup. Another thing, there was going to be a lot of environmental education and sustainability and species and so on. But none of that really interested either him or me. The really amazing thing was it also said that they were going to go on lionfish hunts. And I thought, wait, this is an environmental organization that's going to take teenagers out and teach them how to kill something? So I started Googling it and talking to some of the sort of obvious people you would ask about this, and found out that lionfish were an absolutely massive problem. Outside the Indo-Pacific, you know, lionfish have no natural predators, and they themselves will eat almost anything. There's this one study that I won't ever forget, and it calculated that lionfish can eliminate more than 80% of other species on a reef in just 5 weeks. And beyond that, they reproduce incredibly fast. A female lionfish can lay an average of 27,000 eggs every 2.5 days, and they do it year-round. There are several theories on how lionfish wound up in the water, but my favorite is that people had all these lionfish in their aquariums, and they started noticing that they had fewer and fewer other fish in their aquariums. And after a while, they realized that, in fact, the lionfish were eating their other fish. And so they got irritated because, you know, people spend a lot of money on the fish in their aquariums. And they threw the lionfish into the canal in order to save the rest of their investment. The surprising thing is that when the lionfish found themselves in the canal, they weren't the least bit distressed to be there. And they quickly began the process that we're talking about today of spreading. So they're first sighted off of the Atlantic coast of Florida in the mid-80s. Then, by 2004, they're seen in Bermuda. They're in Cuba by 2007 and the Yucatan Peninsula by 2009. And really, the only thing that will limit their spread is that they don't survive winters in cold temperatures. Otherwise, they're unstoppable.
All right. You guys all good? Questions?
Go.
Perfect. All right, we're going to fire this up and head out.
The thing is, you know, lionfish don't respond to bait. They're not interested in bait, and they won't, generally speaking, bite a hook. Now, you can't net them because they live in reefs and crevices, so your net's going to catch on whatever they're hiding on. What you really actually have to do is you have to go in there and harvest them by hand.
Diving. Inside here, there's a green pelican case that's got oxygen if we had some kind of situation where we needed.
You know, I'm an adequate recreational diver, definitely nothing special. But I assumed I'd be able to hunt some lionfish. That turned out not to be possible because lionfish live over 100 feet deep at this point. So what actually we did was a bit of a cheat or a workaround, is to have another diver go down, bring up a bunch of lionfish to the surface, and then wait there for me.
He's right up next to you then.
You know, lionfish vary in size, and they're bigger in the Atlantic and the Gulf than they are in their native habitat, but they're about 9 inches in length or so.
Don't splash.
All right, relax.
The spear is really essentially a slingshot. It's about 3 feet long. It's made of fiberglass. It has these nasty prongs on the end, and it's launched by virtue of a kind of a rubber band, a very thick rubber band. And when you release it, it actually flies off with incredible speed.
Anyway, you can shoot it any way you want. Closer and pull it all the way back. All the way back.
I keep missing.
You can be like 2 inches from it.
Eventually, I get the hang of the problem that I'm having with the spear, which is I put so much suntan lotion on, so much sun cream, that I can't hold the barrel of the spear. It's sliding away. So they throw me a glove. I went right up to the lionfish. I released the spear via the rubber band, went through this quite small lionfish, and the lionfish died.
Yay! There it is. You got it. Nice.
I think that I felt essentially like I had done something kind of pointless. You know, no matter how bad, in quotes, lionfish are, no matter how invasive, no matter what they do to, like, the grouper stock and how they crowd out other species, you know, again and again in my head was the point that this, like, is not their fault. I mean, we slap these labels on these invasive species. Even the word invasive sometimes made me laugh with the idea that this species had invaded us. Completely the opposite of what really happened. I mean, we grabbed it out of its native environment, put it in our dentist's office for show, and it got out. The thing is, there's this whole community of people who've really gotten into lionfish hunting. It's their passion. It's their hobby. They go out several times a week, and they see how many lionfish they can spear. There are even tournaments now with cash prizes for teams that bring back the biggest haul. And the person in this world who really caught my attention, the one who really fascinated me, is a woman named Rachel Bowman.
Hello.
How's it going?
Thank you for coming.
Rachel Bowman is a woman who lives in the Florida Keys and who is a bartender. That's her profession. But her name kept coming up again and again in sort of scientific papers. She's thanked often. And then when I would start interviewing scientists, they'd be like, oh, I went diving with Rachel Bowman. And I looked up Rachel and I watched some videos of her lionfishing. And she lionfishes, you know, with this kind of incredible intensity. You know, when you're diving, your main job is to survive. I mean, I think that's what most divers have on their mind when they're 150 feet below the water. It's like, monitor my oxygen level, you know, keep everything under control, do my stops, my safety stops, get up, and I'm in good health. Rachel just seemed to have something utterly different on her mind. She had this almost kind of wild bloodlust for lionfish. At least that's what I was kind of interpreting as I would watch these videos taken with GoPros, you know, 100 feet under the water.
Where'd you grow up?
I'm from an island off the coast of North Carolina called Wrightsville Beach. My father was a commercial shrimper and a charter boat captain. So I grew up definitely on the water, in the water. Moved to the Florida Keys and...
She comes from, you know, like many people who I met, she comes from a family that's interested in the well-being of the oceans, but not an environmental point of view.
I'm a bartender. I don't throw garbage on the ground.
Yeah.
I recycle. It's not that I'm not aware of the environmental benefits of what I'm doing. It's just not on my radar.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little bit like people say, I'm not a feminist, but, you know, she functions really as an environmentalist, but she would not want to be called an environmentalist.
No, what was your environmental consciousness as a little girl? Zero.
Dad was a commercial shipper.
Right, so.
My house is full of, you know, pictures of my dad standing at the dock next to a big dead shark or a big dead marlin. He wasn't a terrible person. There just wasn't that mindset. You
absolutely,
know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, anybody that's been on a shrimp boat, it's not pretty. What else comes up in that net and you know, the regard for it, so.
It took me a while to understand, and really, it was in Florida that it hit me full in the face for the first time that this wasn't an environmental story at all. What this really was a story about two aspects of modern America in conflict. So on the one hand, we have this out-of-control population in our waters, and on the other hand, we have a highly motivated group that wants to control them at any price. And I thought to myself, you know, just to see these two in conflict, just to watch how this plays out, you'd see something pretty amazing.
Numbers. How many dives do you think you've gone on for lionfish?
Forget it.
1,000?
Yeah.
5,000?
Yeah.
Any remote estimate of how many pounds of...
I couldn't even begin to give you that number.
So do you make a living, more of a living from harvesting lionfish than from bartending?
No.
No.
God, no.
No. What's the lionfish end of things like worth?
Every year's different. Some years are, I mean, we had some terrible years, mm-hmm. you know, and we had some years that, you know, I bought a boat. So.
You bought a boat with your lionfish?
Yeah. With Britney Spears.
To go get more lionfish.
Yep. We were getting crap money for lionfish until May of 2016. I sold the very first lionfish to Whole Foods in May of 2016. They got a macerator, so they would take the really tiny ones and turn them into lionfish dumplings, which were delicious. That was who changed the game for us as far as money.
I didn't
know
that. Yeah.
My dad died in February of that year, just a few months before that happened. But I think if my dad could have seen his little girl's picture in the frozen fish section of Whole Foods, I think his heart may have burst. I think that was the moment I finally made up for not being a boy.
Do you think that the war against lionfish is being won or lost?
It's so funny. So somebody came into my bar the other day, and there were people sitting at the bar talking about lionfish. And they, you know who I am and what I do. And this guy kind of comes in mid-conversation, and he sits down, and he's listening. And he goes, well, what's the point? He said, well, I read online that, you know, lionfish release, you know, 50 million eggs a year. So what's the point? And I looked at him and I said, well, first of all, that's an inaccurate number. It's like 2 million eggs a year, I think. And what's the point? I'm not sitting on a bar stool, you know, wheezing, being 300 pounds, drinking a beer. I'm out there doing something. That's the point.
You know, and it's true what Rachel's saying. She's definitely not just sitting around. She's working really hard, even if it seems sometimes like she's involved in an impossible, endlessly uphill battle. But I also think there's something else that motivates her, and it's this. Unlike other invasive species, unlike stink bugs, unlike cane toads in Australia, lionfish are edible. And they're not just edible, but they're really delicious. They taste like cod or some other tasty white meat fish that you'd want to eat. So if we looked at them from a different point of view, we could really say that lionfish aren't a scourge at all, but a gift of food, a really nutritious, low-fat food that people would actually want to eat. So then we just lack one thing. What we lack is a mechanism to efficiently harvest them, because no amount of Rachel Bowman's in the water is ever going to get enough lionfish to put them on tables across America. But I have hope still, because, and this is something that someone I interviewed told me, and it's really stuck with me. He said, if there's one thing humans are really good at, it's eradicating species for money.
Staff writer D.T. Max. You can find his full report on lionfish on our website, newyorker.com. Coming up, we meet a warrior for voting rights who's taking two cases this fall to the Supreme Court.
It is election vigilantism, and we cannot let it take hold.
Political lawyer Mark Elias. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The midterm elections are 7 weeks away. And they're often cast as a referendum on, sometimes a reckoning on, the president and his party. This year, however, some see democracy itself on the ballot. And one of those people is Mark Elias. He's a lawyer and a staunch Democrat. But even Steve Bannon has said he admires Elias, saying he's crazy, but a fighter. Elias is fighting some of the most high-profile cases involving voting rights in the United States. The Supreme Court will hear two of those cases in its upcoming term, which starts next month. Staff writer Sue Halpern recently profiled Elias for the magazine, and as she was reporting her piece, Sue could often only reach Elias late at night, sometimes past midnight. But recently she caught him at the relatively civilized hour of 8 p.m.
It seems to me, given the fact that every time we talk, you're sitting at your desk and it's late at night, that this work is no longer a job. It feels to me that you've found something that you are so passionate about that you can't stop.
Yeah.
Is that, which made me think that maybe you sleep in your chair.
No, I don't sleep in my chair, but I wake up thinking about this. I work all day at it. I spend my weekends worrying about this. I really believe that when the history books are written, what they write about our generation will be whether or not we were able to preserve democracy or whether we were the generation that lost it.
That's the way Mark Elias sees his work, as saving the soul of the country. When I spoke to him via Zoom, he was at home in Northern Virginia in his makeshift TV studio, complete with a backdrop of photos of his dogs. Elias is a political lawyer. He told me his job is to help Democrats win elections. He was counsel to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, and he's also worked for Bernie Sanders. But his mission has expanded. Exactly a year before we spoke, he founded his own law firm, the Elias Group, that's focused primarily on beating back efforts to undermine democracy.
So you once told me that you were born a Democrat. What was it like growing up in your house? Was it super political? Why do you know that you were born a Democrat?
You know, I was born in a New York Jewish New Deal family. And it never occurred to me that a growing up as the child of, two parents who grew up in the Great Depression and were Jewish, that you could be anything other than a Democrat. My family wasn't super political, but it was, there was never a question that my family were Democrats.
It was just in your DNA somehow.
I think the sense was that, Franklin Roosevelt and then John Kennedy, that they had done a lot for Jewish Americans, that there was a welcome place in the Democratic Party for immigrants, other racial and ethnic minority communities, and that was what the Democratic Party represented. Also, I didn't grow up wealthy, and the Democratic Party was the party of, people who didn't have millions of dollars.
So you're working on a couple of cases that are going to be argued at the Supreme Court in the next term, specifically thinking about Alabama and also North Carolina. I'm wondering if you could just take us through that a little bit. What's at stake in Alabama? What's that case about? And then similarly with North Carolina, which are very different.
They're very different, so let's talk about them in that order, which is the order that they'll be heard by the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court will begin its term in October, as it always does, and one of the very first cases it will hear for argument is a case out of Alabama that involves the redistricting that took place after the last census. After the 2020 census, the state of Alabama drew one district in which black voters could elect their candidate of choice. We believed that, and our clients believed, that Alabama should have to draw two districts that black voters could elect their candidate of choice.
The significance of the Alabama case is that it has the potential to gut a significant part of the Voting Rights Act, which is the part of the Voting Rights Act, it's called Section 2, that makes it unconstitutional, illegal, to disenfranchise voters on the basis of race. Essentially, this case has the possibility of making it impossible in the future for other communities of color to use the Voting Rights Act to seek relief for discrimination.
So we sued and we won. And what's important for people to realize is that this case that we brought under the Voting Rights Act was heard by three federal judges, two of whom were appointed by Donald Trump, one of whom was originally appointed by Ronald Reagan. So this was not exactly a gimme court. And they found in our client's favor, they found that the Voting Rights Act, in fact, required the construction of a second black district. That case was then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear that case.
And what are you going to argue? What's the strategy?
So our argument is really straightforward, which is that the Supreme Court has for 30 years had a standard. And unfortunately, in states like Alabama, there are still high degrees of racially polarized voting, where white voters simply won't vote for the candidate of choice of the black community.
So tell us about North Carolina, what's going on there.
So I will predict right now that next June or July, when we're at the end of the Supreme Court term, that the biggest case of the term will be Moore v. Harper. So here, what happened is the North Carolina legislature passed a hideously gerrymandered map again, a congressional map. We brought a lawsuit on behalf of a group of individual plaintiffs, the lead plaintiff being someone named Harper. We brought a lawsuit under the North Carolina State Constitution. The North Carolina Supreme Court said, yep, this violates it, and ordered a new map, a fairer map. And so the Republican legislature of North Carolina has now brought that to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is a very, very, very dangerous case because their theory, and it is just a theory, it's not anything that any court has ever adopted, is that where the U.S. Constitution says that the redistricting or the setting of congressional boundaries is determined by the state's legislature, that that means only the legislature and not the courts. So it would essentially eviscerate state judicial constitutions and state judicial review of state legislative acts involving federal elections. Look, this is a cousin, more like a brother, half brother, maybe, of the argument that Donald Trump made after the 2020 election when he said the state legislatures should go ahead and appoint alternate slates of electors.
So spin it out. If they buy that argument, what are the implications?
So look, one of the first cases you read in law school, one of the most famous Supreme Court cases of all time, is Marbury versus Madison, which stands for the proposition that legislatures enact laws and courts have the final say on whether the laws are constitutional. Our system of democracy can't rely entirely on every conceivable act of politicians and political actors being anticipated. We have to have a system in which there are certain norms respected. And one of those norms is a court tells you this is unconstitutional, so you do something different. And what we have lost in the Republican Party is any sense of shame or decency, and therefore they don't abide by those norms.
Who is supposed to hold them responsible to the norms?
It is ultimately the job of all of us as citizens, you know, and that's the part, Sue, that I'm not sure is working, because what you need is the citizens saying, look, we understand the game you're playing, but like, we're not here for it. We're not going to support you if you play these games. You're going to pay, in fact, you're going to pay a penalty. You're going to pay a penalty that goes beyond this place and this time and this election. And I'm just not sure that that's happening right now.
One of the things that I know that you've encountered from your critics is this idea that the Supreme Court is now extremely right-wing, conservative, and as are many state courts, and that in bringing cases that you have the potential to lose, as in any case, you also have the potential to have set pretty bad precedent. What's your response to when people say, Mark, you should not be bringing these cases. Don't bring Alabama. Don't do this because look what's going to happen.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that I don't get that from the voters. You know, I don't get that from the people living under these systems. You know, the black voters of Alabama want fair representation in Congress. It is easy for people in very comfortable circumstances to be playing a long game when the voters are actually suffering in real time. What are we saving these precedent for? You know, if not now, when? You know, like, we're there, guys. Like, there's a, like, we're not saving all of this for the future. If we don't use the tools we have to save democracy today, then we may have a wonderful museum of unused tools in the future, but we won't have a democracy to use them in the future. And therefore, you really can't worry about what the precedent is going to be, you know, for 10 years from now or 20 years from now.
We are about a month and a half away from the election. Is that about right? I'm wondering, given the work that you've been doing, I know that you filed a case today, actually, in Nevada. Do you anticipate more voting rights stuff coming down the pike between now and then, or is it too late?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And we are beginning to see a steady stream of efforts by Republicans and conservatives to prepare to subvert the outcome of the election by either disqualifying large numbers of voters for specious or no reasons, or setting up counting rules or systems that will not accurately count ballots, or simply refusing to certify accurate results. And so we've seen a little bit of all of that in the last few weeks, and that is a growing and worrying trend that I expect we will see in the coming weeks and then in the immediate aftermath of the election.
Right.
The largest voter challenge or disqualification we've ever seen as a country was in 1964 in Alabama and Mississippi. The second largest was in 2021 in Georgia, where Republicans challenged the eligibility of 364,000 voters, which was 8% of the total number of votes cast in the runoff Senate elections. We were able to beat that back in court. We were able to say to judges, like, this is ridiculous, can't do this. But as we sit here today, there have been more than 65,000 challenges already lodged this year. This year, 65. We're only in the beginning of September. 37,000 of them were lodged in a single county today. Gwinnett County. This was 37,000 challenges on one day in one county. It is a mass challenge. And it's not just Georgia. You know, we have seen Republicans gathering the tools to do this throughout the country, and we're starting to see evidence of them do this in other states as well. It is election vigilantism, and we cannot let it take hold.
So this is important because when Governor Kemp, the governor of Georgia, signed, you know, one of the most restrictive voting acts ever in last year, one of the parts of it says that anybody in the state can challenge the legitimacy of any other voter, as many challenges as they want to, bulk challenges to voter after voter after voter. And in this case, they were doing it on the basis of, like, discrepancies in their addresses. It's a swing district. There are more people of color there. There are more Democrats there than there had been before. I think that as Mark looks at what's going on in the country, particularly with respect to restricting people's ability to vote, he sees it as a kind of, you know, David and Goliath story. I mean, obviously he has a lot of resources, but nonetheless, there is a sense in which, you know, there are these big, powerful forces that he and his team are trying to push back. When we spoke, he kept coming back to this story of a prisoner of war who came to his bar mitzvah class when he was 13, and it seemed to me to be the story that really defines him and motivates him.
He had been an American citizen who had been captured by the Nazis, a Jewish soldier who was put out in a work camp, and for a period of the season, they picked potatoes. And he told us, and it's like vivid in my head, that he and the other Jewish prisoners of war in this camp got little pieces of barbed wire and pressed them against their fingers to poke holes in the potatoes so that the potatoes would rot. I mean, just think of the futility. You think what I'm doing is obsessive and perhaps futile. Here's a 19-year-old kid far from home trying to destroy the German war effort by rotting potatoes, by poking holes with barbed wire and his bare hands one at a time. And so, like, that has stuck with me. So I'm going to be poking holes in the potatoes until there's nothing left to poke holes in.
How do you get other people to poke holes too? I mean, you've now assembled, you know, 70 some odd people to poke holes. How do you get people to be that passionate alongside you?
So I think part of it's a success and part of it's a failure. So the success is what you just said. Like, you know, we've been able to recruit a tremendously talented group of lawyers who are passionate about this. You know, Gen Z and young millennials get a lot of bad rap, but not from me and my firm. Like, the passion that they have for progressive issues, like, really aligns with our law firm. So we don't have trouble finding really, really talented, excellent lawyers. The place where I have failed, candidly, is I'm not sure I'm reaching the people who are listening to this podcast. I don't feel like Americans understand and prioritize what is happening. And that is where I feel like the greatest need is, but I feel like I am not accomplishing what I need to. I'm not optimistic. I'm just going to do everything I can.
That was political lawyer Mark Elias, and he was interviewed by staff writer Sue Halpert. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. Next week, we'll have Questlove in conversation with songwriter, singer, and producer Maggie Rogers.
Music is not a job. It's a way of being. Like, it's a part of you. I mean, to me, at least.
Yeah, I'm glad you know that at 20, because I had to learn that at 50. You know.
And please, don't hesitate to come to our website, newyorker.com, if you're interested in tickets to any of our events, to the New Yorker Festival, which is back for the first time in a long time, completely live on stage. newyorker.com is the place to go. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli. And special thanks this week to Jules and Flora Max for production help on location with staff writer DT Max.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.